Yo.
There's certain things that I can talk to you about that I can't really with my dad.
I don't think we should talk about this.
We're starting off a new series of our podcast. I'm Lynn Ponton, and we've run a series, Let's Talk About Sex, another series before, and we have some of the same people back, or the same three of us. Jen, unfortunately, has left our group for a short period of time, and we miss her greatly, but we're still continuing to talk about topics relevant to the world, hopefully, and to us as therapists. So this is a new series, Therapists Talk Taboo Topics, and we're starting with podcasts really looking at abuse and the high-risk areas of abuse. Today, we're going to be talking about how we're all to some degree complicit with abuse, or we can be pulled into complicity, or we see complicity in our patients or our families and how we deal with it. Other topics in the sex abuse series we're going to be talking about are grooming, treating sexual abusers, as well as treating those who've been abused. So I'm hoping that this is a very relevant topic to the world at large, and definitely to our listeners. As I said earlier, my name is Lynn Ponton, and I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist with more than 40 years experience at and have worked largely in San Francisco at UCSF. So you want to go ahead next? Sorry, you have a lot of experience and a lot in this area, really.
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. So I'm Soy. I've made an appearance, I think, a few times on the Let's Talk About Sex podcast, and was super honored to be there and really glad to be doing this series with you, Lynn and Valerie. I'm an associate marriage and family therapist, pretty close to licensure now at this point, but I've been doing work around sexual abuse specifically for, I believe, the last 7 years, maybe over 7 years at this point. And this area has always been really fascinating to me because of how complicated it is. And there is no clear cut answer to these things. So just really excited to be a part of this.
I'm really excited that you're part of it, because your area of research and interest is really sexual abuse. And you've worked with patients from all sides, you know, from those who've been abused, the abusers, all of that. So it's a big area to be involved with, and really relevant to the world.
Yeah, especially now with Me Too, that, you know, that whole movement that came, and I think it probably came up even more again after Roe v. Wade. And it's been an interesting time, I think, to be doing this work. Oh, and I guess I should also explain that in the work that I was doing, I was not only counseling, but doing medical accompaniments, forensic interview accompaniments, law enforcement accompaniments to survivors of sexual abuse. And I do currently also treat folks who have abused others. Pass the torch to you, Valerie.
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Valerie. I'm currently a student earning two master's degrees, one in forensic psychology and the other in counseling psychology. I just started this semester, and I've been working with Lynn for a little over a year and a half now, I think, and I've met Soy along the way, and hopefully following in their footsteps with more forensic psychology work, and excited to eventually earn my licensure in marriage and family therapy one day. So I'm here to help facilitate the conversation, since I don't have a degree yet. I don't know how much I can speak, and I'm not super experienced like Soy and Lynn are, but I think we'll just get started on the topic today, which we're going to be talking about complicity and grooming and abuse.
And although you don't have all the clinical experience all the years, Valerie, you have a lot of energy.
Yes.
That makes a big, a big difference. And you looked up some basic definitions about complicity. So we could start maybe talking a little bit about that.
Definitely. So when you look up complicity on Google, the first thing you see is that it's described as the state of being involved with others in an illegal activity or wrongdoing. So of course, this seems like something maybe not everyone identifies as being a part of. No one wants to think that they're doing something illegal or assisting in wrongdoings, but it's a lot more common than we could initially think.
And where we see it come up often is in working with the individuals who've been either sexually abused, or abusing others. Complicity plays a really big role in that. So that's where during the last 2 years, it seems to become very, very popular. Really, the terminology is out there. And you brought up the case of the royal family. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about this. And Prince Andrew is an individual within the royal family, one of the sons of the late Queen Elizabeth, who's really been accused of sexual activity, illicit sexual activity. And then the family has certainly played a role in that. Mm-hmm. So that's all over the headlines, mm-hmm. but that's one example. Mm-hmm. But I would say in my own practice, I see it every day. What about you, Soy?
Yeah, I don't know too much about the royal family, but we see it in families a lot. We see it in communities. We see it, I think, systemically a lot too. I think we've mentioned in a previous conversation how the system is set up in a way that where people either have to be complicit in some way, even if it's indirectly or subtly, in order to be a part of society. And when you are someone who goes against the grain, then you can be labeled as a rebel or antisocial or so on and so forth. And so it feels near impossible to not be complicit in some way in these abusive cycles.
Seeing most of my work is with children and adolescents, though I work with adults who've been abused as children and adolescents, I often see mothers who come in with their sons for treatment or for evaluation, and the school has told them that their little boy is involved either in physically abusing or sometimes sexually abusing other kids in the school setting. And so this is something, it's kind of the beginning of the road with very young children. This can really happen. And the mothers, you know, and the dads, there's dads coming in too about it, I think, are trying to decide where that line is. You know, they want to stand by their child. They want to see what's going on. Many want to uncover the problem. Some don't, though. You know, I've worked with parents who they're referred in for treatment, but they really deny that any problem is going on. They're reluctant to address it, you know, and I think maybe that early denial of a problem when another person has raised it is part of what pulls, you know, all of us into a complicit situation. So not being open to really hearing what you said, that we could all be part of it, yeah. Really complicit.
I think especially with parents too, when they have to set a sort of example for a child, it's really important for them to be able to understand their role and focus on their denial. And I think have attention drawn to that as well. Yeah, because with children, they're so little and you have to be very, you want to understand the influence as an adult and how to handle that with young children.
I was just thinking about how, Lynn, you were talking about denial, and that's like one of the first steps in this abuse cycle for it to be maintained is to deny anything that's going on and sometimes minimize, right? Like, or trivialize. We, back at RTS, one of the phrases that I came to really maybe be triggered by is like, boys will be boys. And that just minimizes and trivializes some of their behaviors. But like, why is that an excuse? Should it be an excuse? And it also, this reminds me of addictions, right? Like the way addictions work is first people deny that there is even an issue and it continues that cycle too.
Absolutely. And you bring up the crossover with addictions and that's kind of down the road. But little kids starting out with this behavior can really be drawn into it and they pick up the denial of their parents. Maybe to start even talking about one of the cases is a little boy who came in was sexually involved in some sex play with his little cousins who are younger, was forced to come in because of there had been a legal complaint filed in all of this. But the mother and the father were very unwilling to see any of this as aggressive or too aggressive or too assertive. And it was a really difficult struggle with them, you know, to get them to see it differently. You know, they did not want their little boy labeled or blamed. That was really what they said, the initial out. And this is many cases, not just the one, but it's really, I think, how parents look at maybe early treatment or early addressing of these behaviors would stop this cycle from really going further. And parents being more open and really not denying so much, being more receptive to even hear some of these not so good things, but to realize that with younger kids, if they get treatment for these behaviors, they can really do a lot better and the behaviors go away. You know, so early identification and treatment of this behavior is really key.
Remaining open, I think, is super key to treatment, right? Like, one of the things I think I mentioned earlier was how gray this area can be and has been in my experience. And I have noticed the shame that comes from people who've been impacted by sexual violence, as in they were the victims, though I don't really like using that word. And the people who assaulted someone, they feel immense amount of shame. Like, I think there's this idea that people who abuse others are these evil people who feel no remorse and are just complete monsters, right? Like, that's how they're portrayed. But that's not really the case. That's not what I've seen. And when there's such stigma like that, how does someone go to treatment and be open to that? How do parents take their children without feeling like, oh, I'm a bad parent or my child is bad, and not have that resistance to treatment? And it also makes me think about how I was just talking about this with my partner the other, like, I don't know, a month ago, but how our legal systems are set up so that people who have had these offenses or assaulted people makes it incredibly hard to reintegrate back into society in a healthy way.
Yeah. And it's maybe that's what we're hoping that this podcast really talks about, is what we've learned, what does work, what does help early, and what prevents this type of pattern of really scapegoating both the abused and the abuser. You know, and both feel shame after something like this. Both are involved in all of this. And certainly the parents do. You were talking about something, you know, Valerie, you were saying being a student is, you know, you don't know as much, but pedophilia came up in your class last night.
Pedophilia did come up in my class last night. I don't know if I'm allowed to share this, my professor said the phrase, pedophiles deserve a special place in hell. And that just did not sit right with me because pedophiles are people too. And we have a recognized disorder for pedophilia disorder in the DSM. And I think that is just was sort of an ignorant comment that rubbed me the wrong way. So I definitely don't like hearing that from professors. But again, I guess that was an instance where I was complicit. I didn't speak up and didn't really feel like I could in that moment because, but afterwards I had classmates text me and we kind of addressed it. So it didn't go unnoticed, but it is one of those things where it's like, these are the people that are teaching future therapists and generations. And it's so fascinating to see how something that feels like so wrong to me, like having her just say that. So, yeah. So I don't know. It's something I noticed, but I definitely rubbed me the wrong way. That's for sure.
But even the fact, Valerie, you could talk to your classmates, text back and forth, address it in that way, and maybe think about bringing it up later in the class, maybe doing a project in that area where you look at what the outcomes could really be. But I think the stigma of being an abuser and certainly being defined as a pedophile is great for people. And it's maybe what the mother and the father of the little boy that I was talking about, they want to avoid that stigma for their little child.
Yeah.
You know, they're fearful and they will deny it to keep their little boy out of that, you know, because that's one of the things they talked about.
Yeah.
You know, they did not want him labeled that way in any way.
Reminds me of Valerie's comment at the beginning too, right? Like, people don't want to believe that they could be complicit in something heinous. And if they think of it as heinous, they're going to really want to try to disavow themselves from, oh, I can never do that. It's not possible, but it is possible. Again, the more I've done this work, anyone can be abused and anyone can be abusive. And it's so important, I think, to take, I think one of the other things that we talked about was how important it is to realize what role you're taking in the world, what role you take in your relationships, and to acknowledge that, like, yeah, I could be someone who's complicit and probably in some way am.
I think learning too about when working with young children, it's helped me to know about some of just the basics of development, just about how impulse control is really difficult, particularly for little boys, and they lag about 2 years behind little girls in this area. And this affects like sexual activity, hitting, a whole range of things. So knowing that this is kind of normal behavior for little boys, but it's still something that has to be addressed. And then something I've seen from our work, Soy, is there's this, you know, the concept of identification with the aggressor, that if a little boy gets hit or he's sexually touched, there's a pull to really repeat that behavior and engage in that with other kids in a really kind of dangerous way. So that, I think, some of these developmental steps really explain why little kids are often engaged in this. But it's really important that they be addressed in a therapy and, you know, school setting.
Okay, we're back, hopefully, up again. We dropped out for a few minutes there, so you might get two recordings kind of patched together. And actually, that's kind of reflective of complicity. It's, we're patching together things and getting them to try to work with ourselves around complicity and also with the patients and people we work with. One topic, we're talking about a little boy and his parents' inability to really see that he had engaged in sexually abusive activity and how painful that was for him. And I think it really gets to how we can all see aspects of ourselves when we're being complicit. And I think for myself, I'll speak of, I came from a family where there was a lot of complicity around childhood sexual abuse. When children disclosed, it wasn't always followed up on. And it was a difficult pattern, really, to come from. And it made me almost not aware of, as a young therapist, what complicity really was, because that was the norm for me to see the world that way. And it's been a long route to really see that we have choices, you know, as people, as children, about what we disclose, how we identify with individuals who are either abusing or experiencing abuse. And there are more choices than we really think.
Yeah. And I think even when adults do choose to come forward and act on not being complicit, they can still be met with people in positions of power that could offer help, but maybe aren't as helpful and are still complicit in themselves. Sort of thinking about like when a therapist is maybe complicit or not, I guess, not as helpful as they could be in the situation. Maybe they don't know themselves how to handle this situation.
I think you bring up a good point, Valerie, about therapists, because all three of us are therapists in process, and therapists can be complicit too. And I think one way not to be complicit is to really illustrate the choices that the family and the child has. There's more than one here. And the other is really to talk about your own risk as a therapist of being complicit. You'd be complicit if you ignored this abuse. You know, that's what I had to say to the mom and the dad. If we ignore this abuse in your son and what he's doing, his behavior, we are being complicit with his behavior and we're not doing him any favors.
Yeah. And the other thing, kind of a rewind here, but, you know, talking about actually going back to what you were saying too, Valerie, when you were in class and you hadn't spoken up at the time, but later on addressed it with other classmates, like sometimes it isn't safe to bring it up in the moment and people find other ways to not be complicit or to break that cycle or system. And one of the things that makes me think about is how women in particular in the past, and I think still now too, when they were in, and I shouldn't say all women, but people who have been in domestic violence situations had to find more subtle ways of leaving the relationship because their safety was at risk. And I think if there are ways that you can do it more explicitly to address these issues, totally go for it. But if you're not feeling safe and you want to find other ways, I think there, you know, you can find alternative ways to challenge complicity too.
What are some of the ways you'd think of that women could use in those abusive relationships? I mean, one thought I had about this family, Soy, was that the mother was being more complicit because she was worried about what the dad would do if their son was identified as an abuser. So she might have been more open, really, to addressing the son's behavior, but she was, you know, there was a specter here that the dad had a different perspective.
Well, kind of something that Valerie did was getting like a network or network of people who will support like the goal or whatever it is that people are trying to accomplish. Like, I think this is also why my colleague and I had talked about wanting to start a group for like specifically for people who have perpetrated sexual assaults, because there isn't that support for them and for their significant others, because they're all being impacted by it too. And it's so important to have resources, first of all, and then accessibility to those resources so that we can prevent these problems or address these issues. And I wonder, you know, for this mom in particular, if she were to be able to talk to other parents and be like, hey, you know, my child has had this issue or is having this issue, and other parents are like, yeah, us too. Like, what have you done? And it feels less stigmatizing.
Yeah, no, I think those resources are lacking, but they would be extremely helpful. You think of how helpful the AA and NA models have been as a, you know, a real component in the structure of treatment. It's amazingly helpful. And this mom and dad felt really isolated. One thing I did do, Soy and Valerie, I hooked them up with other parents whose little boys have gone through that. So I think it's one thing that a therapist can provide. The teacher in this case, there was a teacher involved, was also helpful with it because she had some resources that were available. But I think giving them resources so they recognize that this is a common problem with young children is helpful.
Yeah. And what better place to start is in young age?
That gets to, you provided information about some of the red flags early on with child abuse, like inappropriate touching and tickling. And we'll try to connect these with our podcast, or giving inappropriate treatment, creating one-to-one time that's inappropriate. And kids can even do that, you know, so there's a lot of places where we could really look for, opportunities for this to happen and maybe cut them off or change them. Any other thoughts about the whole area of complicity things? It's a big, big topic, but anything else that either of the two of you can think of that would be really important for our listeners?
I mean, I'm just thinking about how we were kind of mentioned the royal family earlier and how complicity happens on such a large scale as well. Like, we see it on a smaller scale where it affects these families and a family structure, but then we also see it at large and how world powers and people with a lot of power also have this component of complicity sort of revolving. It is a cycle.
It really has affected, if you look at the Prince Andrew situation, it altered the whole funeral proceedings for mm-hmm. Queen Elizabeth, because they had to alter his role in it. Mm-hmm. She paid out a large amount of money to cover some of the cost of alleged victims, and like $12 million. And, you know, that's kind of a grown-up mother with a grown-up son, but the abuse is still ongoing. And he continues to deny it. That's the biggest issue, even when he's faced with the number of individuals coming forward and talking about it. I think you and I talked, Valerie, about how he did a categorical denial, which is kind of the way that many times it goes. But I wonder, was he a little boy like this little boy engaged in sexual abuse? It wasn't followed up on. And now you've got, you know, an individual who's really in his 60s you know, engaged in it.
Mm-hmm. And he has a lot of power now.
A lot of power. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
I also, I think we've talked about this before, maybe not on this podcast, but maybe on the previous, we talk about this a lot at the last site that I was working at, where I did this really specific work about how sexual abuse is not about sex, which I think is often misconstrued, but a lot of it is around power and control over others. And in that too, right? Like, we had this philosophy that hurt people, not to say that it should be used as an excuse, but people who have been hurt, that's what they've learned. They've learned to hurt others. And that's, the more power and control you have over someone else, maybe the less scared you might feel.
False sense of control, even.
And it brings us back to the little boy who, you know, he had been hurt by other little kids and then was, you know, using this. We use that mechanism, identification with the aggressor. But then he engaged really in aggressive power control over others. So it's really a difficult pattern that has to be addressed. You know, and I think the fact that people think of it as sex, when really it's a violence, is really the first thing that should come to mind, Soy, with it.
Absolutely.
The next topic we're going to be talking about on this podcast, once we work out our difficulties with our internet and other things, is moving on after complicity and talking about one of the topics we're going to talk about is grooming, is really how we're pulled into it. And, you know, really to be more aware of some of the red flags we were talking about. Other subjects that we're going to talk about more directly, though it's come up today, is really treating individuals who've been abused and treating abusers, which I think is an area that there really is very little information about. And then maybe last in the podcast, where we have six kind of sessions planned, is how to prevent abuse. And sex education is a big part about that. And watching what's going on with sex ed in our country, where they're getting rid of it, you can almost see these patterns starting earlier and earlier and not being stopped or not being addressed.
Well, it has been a pleasure to be able to talk about this with you all. And hopefully it opens up conversations for, I'm hoping, a large audience of other people where we can openly talk about this. And also, not to say there shouldn't be consequences, but maybe there can be a combination of consequence, conversation, and rehabilitation.
I certainly support that, Soy. And, you know, again, I think we can, from our experience, we can really hope to inspire those conversations and really get them going. So thank you both, Valerie.
Thank you, Lynn and Soy.
Thanks, everyone.